Good evening. Thank you for coming. I'm Steve Weiland, director of MSU's Jewish Studies program. Before we start tonight, I just want to remind you that we have a few more events, Jewish Studies events, coming up in the next several weeks. November 7th, a week from tomorrow, David Mendelson from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, who will be here to teach a new one-credit course in the history of Zionism in Israel, which will also begin next week. David will speak in an afternoon program a week from tomorrow on international perspectives on Jewish education. Then on November 12th, a Monday evening, in conjunction with the MSU Museum, which is mounting a small but unusual show of painting inspired by historical Jewish themes, paintings by Tom Block, a Washington, D.C. artist. On Monday the 12th in the afternoon, there'll be a conversation with Tom in the gallery about his paintings. Then in the evening, Elliot Ginsberg, one of the leading scholars of Jewish mysticism who teaches at the University of Michigan, will be here to give a lecture on the paintings and the Baal Shem Tov at the Kresge Museum on campus. And then on November 20th, we'll continue our series of screenings of Israeli films. Details on all of the programs are on the yellow Jewish Studies calendar, which are in the back with some newsletters and other things that you can help yourself to when you leave. For tonight's program, we have Ken Walser to thank. Of course, that's true of virtually everything we do in Holocaust education and most things we do in Jewish studies. Ken saw this film this past spring. He contacted the producer and director immediately, which led to an extraordinary email and telephone relationship with our special guest. Now I want to turn the program over now to Ken Walser.
I'm really pleased, with permission from the filmmaker, Lisa Gossels, to introduce this award-winning film, The Children of Shaban, made in 1999. It's a story of child saving and rescue in France during World War II. There were indeed many such stories. Involving the OSE, pronounced OSE, the Ouvre de Secours aux Enfants, Child Aid Society, and focusing on a group of German and Austrian Jewish refugee children who were brought together in a chateau in Chaban, in the Creuse area, a rural area in unoccupied France, 1940 to 42. A reunion of the children who are now in their 60s and 70s with several of their teachers, still alive, at Chaban in 1996 provided to Lisa Gossels the opportunity to interview key people and bring the story together. Among the children of Chaban are her father and her uncle. And she made the film, she's written to me, as a professional labor of love. The film has been shown on HBO and Showtime. It was featured at the US Holocaust Memorial Museum when the courageous efforts of the OSE were honored in November 2000. And I learned this weekend that the film won the Emmy Award for Best Documentary this year, although nobody knew it because the Emmys were not broadcast. So it's the stealth Emmy. I'm also pleased to introduce to you, Norbert, would you stand up? Norbert Bacalus, who is one of the children of Chaban, who will offer comments and respond to questions during the discussion that will follow the film. Dr. Bacalus is featured in the film. You'll see him as soon as the film begins. And you'll see him throughout the film. He's remarkable in the film. And in recent years, he has served as the vice president of the World Federation of Holocaust Child Survivors and as the secretary of the OSE, which continues to exist as an organization. After the uprooted childhood in Germany and France that's only hinted at in this film, and after escape to Switzerland, Norm Bacalus came here to the United States, to Brooklyn, to New York. He earned an undergraduate degree at CCNY, went on to earn a doctorate in organic and polymer chemistry at Brooklyn Polytech. He had a productive career in industry. He taught at Rutgers, and he spent the last 19 years serving as the director of the National Science Foundation Polymers Program. He is a distinguished scientist who's been recognized for his contributions by professional associations and organizations around the world. He's here today, though, to speak biographically, not about polymers, although the engineers had him over in the engineering building all afternoon. The Children of Chabon zeroes in on the contributions of people like Felix Chevrier, the school director of Chabon, and Irene and René Payasu, teachers at Chabon, who offered to these family-less refugee children education in safe haven from 1940 to late 1942. Until after August and September of 42, the children began to be dispersed in the face of the increasingly aggressive Nazi assault. They were sent to hiding in the forests, to French homes and institutions, and later across the border along dangerous passages into Switzerland. A handful of the children were deported to the Nazi death camps. We see two who came back from Auschwitz in the film in a very understated way, and we understand the context. Very good piece of filmmaking in that regard. Most of the children, though, were never deported. They were secreted away to safety, and they survived outside the Nazis' clutches. The film, you'll see, is also shaped by conventions that have grown up regarding such filmmaking, emphasizing in this film, as in others that some in the audience may know, I know my colleague Ron Doerr teaches about this film, that emphasize the local community of rescuers who do good in an evil time. That's the convention. In this film is something like Pierre Sauvage's Weapons of the Spirit, about the villagers at Le Chambon-sur-Lignon who did good in an evil time. Although those of you who are interested will find in the back of the room a piece by Pierre Sauvage, which appears on his foundation internet site, which is critical of this film, praises it but also criticizes it. And we may talk about that a little bit after the film. I should also say that the film hints at and mentions, but doesn't really explore, the very complex organization and movement networks that made such communities and acts of goodness possible in the first place. The people who took these children to these places and then took them to the forest and took them through the dangerous passages. Nor does the film look beyond Chabon at the Ose homes and communities that were close nearby, or the challenges once the children were dispersed of the actual crossings to Switzerland. Very close by Chabon were three other Ose homes. There were 15 in the unoccupied zone of France, and there were three close by. One at Montintin near Limoges, one at Morel near Vichy, and one at Majayer near Limoges as well, all close to Chabon. And some of you who know some French history and know the name of the leading Holocaust researcher in France, Serge Klarsfeld, he was a child at Majayer, close by. Majayer is mentioned in the film. The Ose, which operated legally during the war and openly, gradually shifted toward illegality and clandestine activity after 1942. And it figured in the rescue of several thousand children. The number we were talking the other night, maybe 5,500 children saved. This film is about one chateau and one group of children in that larger story.
Is it on?
Yes, it is.
Well, I'm the guy who hasn't changed in all these years. I don't know why everybody laughs when he says that, but anyway. I think this is it's a marvelous film. You can see not only the love of the people, but also the love of Lisa Gosselz in making this film. It was a film that was made on a shoestring. This is not a professional film with a huge budget where people were done in the studio with makeup. You could see that people didn't have any makeup on, and it was spontaneous. It has the strength of spontaneity. We didn't take any second recording. There were no second takes. You said what you had to say, and that was it. You didn't get a second chance. Oh, I should have said that, or this and the other. For those of you who were sharp, you might have noticed that the film starts with, unfortunately, with the deportation of my brother and my father on the 29th, I said, of October 1938. Today is the 30th of October. So it's a painful period. It still is a painful period for me. I think there's so many things that one could say about this film, so many things one could say about the period, that I really would prefer if you asked me the questions and I responded to them. And I would be very willing to do this for as long as you care to stay. And after everyone is gone, if some of you want to stay and continue, we can do this all night if you wish. So who will be the first one? It's got to be a first one. There's always a first one. There'll be a second, a third, a fourth, and much more than that. Yes. Thank you. Wait till you have the microphone, please.
Your education seemed very comprehensive for just a little orphanage type of thing. Do you feel now, after being so highly educated, looking back, that it was very good education for the conditions?
Well, that's actually a very good question. The two sisters whom you see there, and you just cannot say enough good things about them. It's everything that was said about them is true, and then more so. They were just absolutely outstanding people, outstanding teachers, outstanding in every sense. And they really made us work. I think you heard me say you had to conjugate verbs, and you had to learn, you had to do science, as Peter Gossel said, and we had a very good education. The trouble was, it was interrupted. You know, I was asked before this started here whether this was the only place where I was in France. It was one of five places where I was hidden in France. I was there for 2 years, but we were thrown out of school, as you remember, so I wasn't really in that school for very long. It was, yes, the education by those two teachers, I would say thanks to those two teachers, was magnificent, but it didn't last. It didn't last. It was an interlude and then a very, very tough and difficult period for children. Yes?
I think you can probably hear me, Michael. Yes. Wolfie is quite an interesting man in what he endured to miss the lottery or be picked. I'm intrigued, and I can't remember if it was you or another gentleman said that throughout his internment, quite possibly ruined his youth and his adulthood. He seemed to be very vigorous. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about him?
Well, it's. Did you hear the question, by the way, or should I repeat it? I should repeat it? Okay. The question was, what happened to Wolfie after the war? He seemed well put together and vigorous. Wolfie, I think, survived because he was so athletic. You know, he hid himself in the rafters of the toilets, you know, holding on for these so-called appels that the Germans had lasted an hour, sometimes 2 hours. And you know, this is not something you go up there for a few seconds. He hid there. He found this way of hiding. It was because he was so athletic, as was said in the film. He came back a destroyed person. He came back really destroyed. I'm sorry to say this. I'm very sorry to say this about my friend, but he has just never really been what he was in his youth. It's sad to say. Jerry Girard, on the other hand, the other one, had a what seemed, if you didn't know that he had been in Auschwitz in these 14 camps or 15 camps, I forget what he said, you would never have known it. You would never have known it. To me, the most haunting moment in this film, I don't know if it was for you too, is when Wolfie recalls the time in a concentration camp. At one moment, he sort of stops speaking, and you see his look is distant. It is as if he can see the past again. All these horrors are coming back. I find it devastating. And these weren't staged. This was utterly spontaneous. Utterly spontaneous. I find that the most meaningful moment of the film to me. Yes?
Hello. I'm like wondering, were you guys bilingual? I'm completely fascinated with individuals who can speak like multi like languages and communicate with each other in different like forms of like diction, whether it's like French, Hebrew, like whatever, you know. It's extremely fascinating. So I was wondering, did you guys speak like multi languages, and who taught you, and I don't know.
Languages. Well, I grew up speaking German. I grew up in Berlin. Till I was 10, I lived in Berlin, speaking German, just like all other kids in Berlin. And at age 10, I was suddenly transported without my parents, as you heard, with a group of children, and I found myself in France, and I had to learn French in an awful hurry, in an awful hurry. We arrived in July. By September, I started school in French. There was no bilingual education or whatever, you know. You just went to class. They did make a I'm thinking French. You see, I speak French now also. But my thinking is in French, and I'm trying to answer you in English. They made some accommodation. The accommodation was that they put me one grade below my normal age, so that what actually was being discussed in class was more or less subject matter that I knew, more or less, although French history I certainly had no idea, French grammar I had no idea, but it was more or less that. And then a few months later, they moved me up to my grade. So it was sink or swim, and I swam. And the same was when I came to America at age 17. I barely knew any English. I certainly didn't know any conversational English. And I arrived in July, and September I started school. And I didn't stop until I had my doctorate. You know, this is my story. I'm not saying this is the story of everybody, but I'm telling you my story. Yes, sir, in the back. Who knows? What gave him the courage? Well, I think the film, in a sense, is a bit idealized. Everyone was not so courageous at every moment. Every person was not that courageous at every moment. But when the chips were down, the people who were really courageous were certainly included. People like Félix Chevrier, who is a director, the handsome man with the hair, with laurel of white hair. The Payasu sisters came through when it was needed. Not only were they good teachers, but they were ready to stand up for their principal. One of them was fired for standing up for her principals. And by the way, unfortunately, she passed away last year. Last November, we lost her. but her, the tall sister, who's the older one, is still alive, and I saw her in May of this year. They were people of extraordinary courage. The people in the village were villagers. They were simple folks. They were simple folks. When somebody came, can you put up somebody overnight? They usually did. Many times you had to pay them for the privilege of putting up children overnight or for a few days. As I wrote in a composition on the subject that I wrote for the archives of the city of the township in which Chaban is located, I said, I call it bribes or call it compensation for the expenses that they had to incur to keep these children. Who knows? You know, who knows? But they were paid. The villagers were paid for hiding the children. I don't know where all of them were paid, but this was the norm. That much I can tell you. It's like all human events. They're gradations. They're gradations. I wouldn't say everyone was a hero. I wouldn't say everyone was bad. It's very interesting. When this film was shown in France in Chaban, it created a scandal. It was a scandal. They called me up. I wasn't there. I was invited to be there, but I couldn't come. And they called me up the next day, and a friend of mine who still lives in the village called me up. He said, Norbert, you've got to talk to Lisa to change that film. I said, well, what's the matter? Well, the naming of that swine who denounced Payasu, Monsieur Joigny, the children and the grandchildren still live there. And they were scandalized that their family had been singled out. So I dutifully called up Lisa, and Lisa says, I'm not changing a thing, it's the truth, isn't it? Yes, sir. It is absolutely correct. What the historian said, there were two historians there, Michaud and Castille. Michaud, unfortunately, has several of the people, of the older people there, have since passed away since the film was made. One of the two historians is no longer alive. But it's absolutely true. These people were extremely primitive. They didn't read. They didn't read. And so they didn't read all of this anti-Semitic literature that was being propagated. They didn't have a radio. They didn't listen to the radio where anti-Semitism was being propagated. And they didn't go to mass either much. Right now, there's not even a church that operates in that area. So it's I don't know this for a fact, but the explanation that's given in the film, which I'm ready to accept, is that at the late 19th century, when Paris was completely rebuilt after the war of 1870, Paris was completely, well, what you consider Paris, the old Paris, really dates back to the post-1870 period. This required a lot of labor. The labor came from the Creuse, or all the farmers who couldn't make a living. It was very hard to make a living as a farmer in the Creuse. They went to Paris to build those houses. And they came back, as it was said in the film, I don't know this, this is what the historian said, they came back with these, what they call the idées laïques, which means they were no longer religious. They lost their religiosity in Paris. They came back just secular.
I raised the question because that's a striking difference between the people of Le Chambon.
Absolutely. In Le Chambon, there was a Protestant, it was a deeply religious Protestant or community that, under the direction of the religious authorities, made a decision to save children. Here it was more, should I use the word spontaneous, but certainly more individual. Certainly, there was no organized effort. The organized effort, there was an organized effort, but the organized effort came from the Jews, the OSE, the Jewish organization OSE, is the spirit behind all of this. This is something that's rarely said, that Jews organized to save Jews, and particularly Jewish children. I'm giving a talk on that very subject, the rescue of Jewish children by Jews, next Sunday at Queens College in New York City. And that's my topic. So if you want to hear half hour talk, I'm ready to get. But no, it really, this is true. This is a subject that is almost never, there's been an enormous amount of literature on the Holocaust and films and all. There's very little that has been written or said about how Jews organized to save other Jews, particularly children. And children were saved because it was realized that they were out to exterminate the whole Jewish people. And the only way for Jewish people to survive is if the young people survive, to assure a future for the Jewish people. This was a deliberate, organized effort by the OZE. And so, yes, there was organization, but it came from a different direction than in Chambon. I don't know. I pass. You decide.
Okay, I'll pass it afterwards. At first, after the war, people weren't talking for so many years. Then the stories came out about the horrors of what happened. I find it really interesting now, in the last 5 or 6 years, there's the film that's come out now, Into the Arms of Strangers,
yes,
about the kinder transport
Absolutely.
To England.
Yes. Which by the way, I recommend to all of you. It's a film that's shown, it's commercially distributed, and it was made with big money by Warner Brothers. But it's a magnificent film, Into the Arms of Strangers. Please go to see that. It's about kinder transport. The way we came as groups of children to France, this is about children who went to England. Please, I'm sorry
That's
for
okay.
the interruption.
That's okay. There's also, I remember when I was growing up, we heard, oh, well, the Danes helped save the many Jewish people. Now the story's coming out, has come out in several different books, and there's a movie, Beyond Hitler's Grasp, about the Bulgarian people who protected many of the Jews. They sacrificed the Macedonian Jews, but they protected, I don't know, 10, 12,000. They sacrificed about 10 or 12,000 and saved about 50,000.
Yes.
But what I'm finding interesting, and also your last comment about talking about the children, helping the children, and in this country, apparently, there were only 1,000 Jewish children brought over by the German Jewish organization, and now some people are following up very carefully on this particular group of people following,
yes,
seeing this film.
You're right. I know that group, yes.
I wonder if you could make some comments. We're talking now 51 years, 50 years since the war. What does this say about the healing process that people, in terms of generations, are going through? You having grown up in your situation, and now you're able to do whatever you're doing to promote awareness. But I think I'm just struck that now in the last 3 years or so, these films about children, and now this wonderful film about children being saved, and what it says in terms of.
Well, I think you could add something else. Steven Spielberg has given a lot of money, has started a foundation to interview as many Holocaust survivors as are willing to speak and tell their story. And if he had offered that 15 or 20 years ago, he wouldn't have had many takers. I'm a polymer scientist. I'm not there. I'm sure that there are psychologists in this wonderful university who can explain the subject much better than I can. I will say this for myself. I can speak for myself. I don't want to make a generalization. I came here alone. I had no help whatsoever. I was 17 years old when I came to this country. Everything that I did, I accomplished on my own. And then later, when I got married together as a family group, we accomplished together. We were too busy building our lives to look into the past. I think Peter Gossels at one point says, you know, I'm too concerned about the present and the future to worry much about the past. That has been totally my attitude here. There are professors at this university who've known me for many years in my professional capacity. They had no idea that I'm, about my past in this. There are colleagues who've seen this film who send me emails and say, I never knew this about you. You never talked about this. I think many of us, I certainly, have a deep sense of privacy. And I think a few years ago I just wouldn't have talked about these things. Just wouldn't have talked about it. Not to strangers, not to someone like Lisa Gossel, whom I didn't know before. She stuck a microphone in front of me and the camera started whirring. I had never met her. You know, I wouldn't have started just because somebody says somebody wants to make a film, say, well, go talk to somebody else. Why me? Why did I? Because this reunion created a spirit in which we relive the past. We were all there. We were all there reliving the past. You know, and this was the occasion was ripe. If she had gone individually to our houses, it would not have been as successful as filming right at that moment. Right at that moment. It was hot off the press, so to speak. Yes. Yeah. I think we're going to wait for a microphone, if you don't mind.
Did you ever go back to Berlin in search of any of your relatives or family that might have survived?
Did you hear the question? Did I ever go back to Berlin to look for relatives or friends or whatever? That's a painful subject. That's a very painful subject. I have no relatives left in Berlin, nor in Germany. None of my relatives are alive. I was 10 years old. I'm sure I had friends, but I don't remember them, and I wouldn't know where to find them now. It's a city of strangers to me. And I will say this, I actively avoided for 45 years, deliberately, actively avoided going back to Germany. I'd probably traveled in 30 countries in the world in my professional capacity, but not in Germany. And it took me 45 years till I finally decided, okay, let me see what's left of where we were. I found the house in which we lived, amazingly untouched. Looked exactly the same as when I lived there. I found a synagogue which had been destroyed during this terrible pogrom in November 38, known as Kristallnacht, which had been burned then, had been rebuilt, and was now being used by Jehovah's Witnesses, who were delighted to see me, received me with the greatest warmth. And I found my Hebrew school. The place where I had Hebrew lessons in the evening. I didn't go to Hebrew school, but I had additional schooling, Hebrew Jewish education after school, and that was done in a school room, and I found that place. It was all still there. My neighborhood is largely unchanged. My neighborhood, it was a terribly, terribly emotional experience to go back, because I felt as if I saw my family right there. You know, I went up to the door, to our door, and I looked at the door and I said, well, this handle, it hadn't changed, this handle. How many times did my father and my mother and my brother turn this handle? You know, it was, what I did was, I did two good things there. As I got into Berlin and as I went to, I went directly to the house where we lived. I recorded it, I had a tape recorder on me, and I had tape recorded my impressions. The other thing was, I was alone. I didn't go with my family because I was there on a, it was a business trip on which I finally went back. And I then that evening, I wrote a five-page letter about my impressions, which my family still has, and I think this will be one of those things that maybe someday we'll donate to the Holocaust Museum. So, yes, going back to Germany was extremely painful for me, and still is. Still is. Maybe in the back, or somebody who has not asked a question yet before we have second rounds. Okay.
Driven
I don't agree with that statement. No, I think there's a whole gradation. I do know people. I know one of the boys from Chaban was a mental case, and he ultimately committed suicide. Other cases, perhaps some of us achieved some things in life, but there's every gradation in between. I do not believe that you can put people in two boxes. I don't. I think this lady here has been trying very hard to ask a question. I'm going to repeat the question, so you don't have to strain.
Where did the OC place you in other parts of France, and how did you get to Switzerland?
The question is, where else did the OC place me in France, and how did I get to Switzerland? This is the part of the film that is not covered. And it's an extremely interesting, perhaps from the historic point of view, from the actions of the OSE, the most interesting and the most courageous period is what during the Germans were there, if you remember. At the end, the Germans came. France was completely occupied by the Germans. How did the OSE save all these children? And that's what I'm talking about next Sunday. But I'll give you an answer right now. You don't have to go to Queens to New York to hear the answer. In my case, what they did was they didn't disperse. You heard the chateau was closed, but it didn't all happen at once. They gradually dispersed children. Whenever they found a haven somewhere, they put children someplace else. They dispersed all the children who were left at the end. I have no idea how many were left at the end. I'm sure that the archives of the OSE can tell us if one can go back. I have no idea. I wasn't there anymore. This happened in November 43. In April 43, the OSE arranged for me to get false papers. It had an industry to produce false papers. I was suddenly born in Paris, which made me very, very proud, because the Jewish kids, they usually made them born in Alsace, because Alsace is the part of France that was very close to the German border. They speak a dialect that's close to German, so if you have a funny accent. I was very proud that for me they said, I'm born in Paris, so it must be that my French must have been pretty good. And they put me on a train with several other boys, and I don't remember how many, maybe three or four of us, were put on a train, and we went to Chambéry. Chambéry is a small city in the French Alps, near the Italian border, and it was occupied by the Italian army at the time. Now, the Italian army was an occupier of France, just as the German army was, but for the Jews, it made a world of difference, because the Italian army did not pursue, or the Italian occupiers did not pursue any anti-Semitic policy at all. In fact, I have since read, I knew that they didn't pursue us. That was pretty obvious when I was there because I lived pretty freely. But I have since found out that they actually prevented the French police from arresting Jews and handing them over to the Germans, which I have read recently, which is quite remarkable, but that I have read. That is, do not take this as historical truth. I can tell you, I wasn't in there. I resumed schooling. There I went to high school there, but it didn't last long because I arrived in April 43, in September 43, June semester was over, so I barely attended school there for just a few months. And in September, the Italians surrendered to the Allies, which had the immediate effect that Germany took over the whole Italian-occupied zone of France, and all of Italy, by the way, also. But also, as far as I'm concerned, the Italian zone of France was now occupied. And it had been a refuge for many, many Jews, because other Jews had heard this is a safe place to go, so it was a magnet for Jews who were in trouble elsewhere to try to make their way there. I succeeded together with the other boys. We arrived there. now we were in trouble. We were again under German occupation. The Germans caught up with me in June 40. They caught up with me again in November 42, as we heard. Now in September 43, they caught up with me again. Well, then the Ose arranged for three boys. I was one of three boys. They arranged for others too, but I was in a small group of three boys. They hired a local peasant, farmer, who showed us the way over the, we went over the Alps, actually. We climbed. This is again where Georges Loinger's good physical education came in handy. He said, you have to run, you have to learn to run, to do this. Well, I ran. We ran, the three of us ran. We managed to get over the Alps into Switzerland. So, and on the other side, in Switzerland, ultimately, the Ose ran homes also for children who were able to go there. So I, after having been put in jail by the Swiss, what do you do with a 14-year-old boy who crosses the border? You know, obviously, you know, I'm, you know, you put him in jail. That's what they did. They put us in prison. That's the first thing they did. So after they ultimately released us from prison, they, by circuitous route, I ended up in Geneva in a home that again was run by the Ose, that wonderful Jewish organization. And that's why I'm personally terribly grateful to them, and I'm the vice president of the organization here in the United States. What we're doing is actually we're raising money to continue the work of the Ose in France. That's our, and we get together periodically and have a good time, enjoy our company. Yes, sir.
Ose apparently operated in France throughout the occupation?
Yes.
How did they pull that off? How did they manage to do that? Did the Germans know they were there?
Yeah. Well,
this did it or what?
Both. Both. What the Ose did was the following. I'm simplifying things. Their first job was to disperse all the children in as many safe places. Many of the girls, for example, were placed in convents. Okay, because that was the church accepted them and hid them. And boys was a more difficult. Some of them were hidden in schools. In fact, in May of this year, I attended a ceremony in France in which the director of a school who had hidden 40 Jewish children in the school was being recognized by Yad Vashem, the same organization that, as a righteous Gentile, same organization that recognized the Pious Sioux Sisters in Chevrier. So then they took themselves false identities. They essentially went underground and ferried children across to Switzerland or into Spain. Spain was another place. And they had to keep visiting the places where the children were being hidden, because in many cases you had to pay those people. And the money came from America, by the way. What the Ose did was they took children across the border into Switzerland, and then the person who had accompanied them took money from the Ose back into France to operate the network that hid children. It was a tremendously complicated. Dozens of Ose adults were caught and murdered by the Nazis. This was not done without pain. This was not done. Some of the children were caught. And there's a terrible story of the home in Isieux where they rounded up everybody and everybody was murdered in Auschwitz, which resulted in the war crime conviction of the SS chief Klaus Barbie. So it's a complicated story, but essentially the Ose went underground in order to save the Jewish children. The truly heroic acts. True heroism in the true sense. Yes, ma'am. Okay, I don't know.
I don't know if the International Red Cross could have done more in regards of bringing this up to the world. They were quiet in Theresienstadt. They admitted that.
The role of the International Red Cross is something that historians are going to have to decide. I, I, I can tell you what the International Red Cross did for me. You know, this is a, I can tell you a personal story, and I will stick to the personal story. The first thing when I arrived in Switzerland, I heard, well, not the first thing I had to get myself out of jail, which was not easy. But once I got out of jail, I heard that the Red Cross ran a service in which they tried to find people who were dispersed by the war. So what you did is you wrote a letter to the International Red Cross, and you said, my name is so-and-so, I was born there and this in this city, and I'm looking for this person born on this date in that city, okay? And they then matched names and addresses and then wrote to people. And I still have a letter, I got back a letter saying, I'm sorry that we are unable to help you. The names that you have given us, we have no record of, okay? That must have happened the end of 43 or early 44. After the war, however, I received a wonderful letter from the International Red Cross saying, we are pleased to inform you that a Richard Bicalis, now living at this and this address, is looking for a Norbert Bicalis. If you think that you are the person he's looking for, then okay. Well, that was my brother who had survived in Poland. The one who was deported in 1938 on the 29th of October, and whom I had not seen. First time we saw each other again was in 46.
You mentioned Easier.
Easier.
Yeah. Okay. Easier. Excuse me. Do you know the book by Saul Friedlander, When Memory Comes?
No.
Okay, because he spent time in and around Mont-Luçon, which is
yes.
in the western part of the Allier, which is near the Creuse, and so I wondered, I guess, if the efforts that were made on his behalf were connected with the OSU.
If he doesn't say it in his book, they weren't. You have his book. Look for it.
Yeah.
I teach
history here, and my students are reading it. And a bunch of them are here. So I just thought.
Oh, well, thank you for bringing them. We have a wonderful audience here.
you know, I just wondered if there was something, you know, directly.
He could. I'll tell you a story like this. My wife was in between Montluçon, the town that you're talking about, and Chabannes. Two-thirds of the way toward Chabannes, was hidden with her mother there. I didn't know her at the time. This was well before we met, many years before we met, but she happened to be hidden there. And she and her mother made their way to the Italian zone exactly the same way. And then her mother arranged for some Jewish youngsters to take her across the border into Switzerland. And when I say youngster, they consider themselves adult, but they must have been all of 18 years or 19 years old, whereas my wife at the time was 11, you know, so they were, you know. She went across. You can get your personal file from the Swiss archives, we discovered recently. So she wrote to the Swiss archives in Bern, and in the Swiss archives it said, she, you know, speaking in person, she was brought across the border by the OSE, which she had absolutely no idea. They were total strangers to her. They were just, you know, she knew they were young Jewish adults who risked their lives to bring her into Switzerland. Now it turns out it was the OSE. So it could, you know, the book that you're referring to could very well have been connected with the OSE too. There are all kinds of these tentacles out there.
Another thing about this book is that his parents were not allowed into Switzerland. They made it to Switzerland.
Yes.
But they were killed.
Yes. Yes.
They couldn't let them in.
Yes. The Swiss had a policy at the time when we were there to accept not all, but some children under the age of 15. I was 14, so I was okay. One of the boys with us was 16. So he very clumsily had, erased the date, the last digit of his birth date, and had written in the date that would make him 14. Well, I mean, it was an obvious fake. I mean, this was, and so we were in prison, and the interrogator kept saying, "How old is this thing?" I said, "I don't know. I've never seen him before." I'd say, "I don't know who he is." But you came across the border. We were arrested together. I don't know. I have never seen him. And so they kept asking and kept asking. In the meantime, we were in jail, and his beard started to grow. I had to look at him and say, "Boy, in trouble." But they kept him anyway. Yes. Ah, did you hear the question, or shall I'll repeat it. Would I share with the audience the interview that I had with the Quakers for possible immigration to the United States? And this is actually the interesting story that parallels Peter Gossels. Peter Gossels came in September 41, he says, with the help of the Quakers. Well, I arrived in Chabon in April 41, and a few months later, two American people, well-dressed, we were all in, I mean, we had terrible clothing. These people were well-fed, well-dressed, had hairstyles that looked like F. Scott Fitzgerald. And it was, I mean, these people were rare. You looked at them, you said, they're Americans. I mean, they was like a caricature of Americans. They came, and they interviewed kids in order to find those whom they wanted to sponsor. And I remember I had to go against the wall, and they hung up a sheet, and they took my photograph. And I still have a copy of that photograph. And say, "Okay, we'll let you know." And then one day, they announced that the kids were going on the next transport, and Peter Gossels and Werner Gossels were among them, but I wasn't. I have no idea why I wasn't picked. I have absolutely no idea why I was not picked. But, and I think now that you're coming to the second part, it's a two-part question. By 1942, that was 41 that I'm talking about, by 1942, there was a second chance. The Quakers came again. Either they, I don't actually remember them coming there, but they said the ones who, maybe they came to interview other kids. They had interviewed me already. They didn't bother. I don't remember meeting them a second time. But they came again, or they made up a second list, and now I was on the list. Great. So I had my suitcase, I didn't have a suitcase, I had a little rucksack. I didn't have too many belongings, believe me. The most precious thing I had were a few photographs of my parents, which are shown in the film. That's what survived. So I was all packed, ready to go, taking the train in the morning. In the morning, I get up, and somebody says, "Did you hear the news?" I said, "What news?" I said, "The Americans have landed in North Africa." I said, "Yay! Hooray! Well, little did I know, this was the end of the diplomatic relations between Vichy and, because of Vichy, there was an American embassy in Vichy. So we could leave from Marseille. American ships would travel freely from Marseille. But now, America was the enemy. They were attacking French territory. So that was the end of my trip. So I didn't get to America in 1942. I had to wait till 46, till after the conclusion of the war. How I did come to America. I was one of the first immigrants to arrive on a plane. So when they say, "You're a greener off the boat," I said, I came on a plane. What happened was that after the war, the Swiss were extremely anxious to get rid of all the refugees that were there. And in fact, in those archives that my wife got, the copies of the archives that she had of her personal file, there were lots of comments and of letters that they'd written saying, "When is she going to leave Switzerland, to wherever she was? When, you know, how soon can you arrange for her to leave Switzerland?" And that was the same for us. So what they did was, they were looking all over. They came to you and said, "Do you have any relatives?" They said, "Well, I remember I have an uncle in New York." Where in New York? I think he was in Brooklyn. And Well, it turns out in Anton, Argentina, materialized, whom I had really forgotten about, but she was my father's sister. My mother's brother lived in Brooklyn, and they were found by somebody, not by me, but somebody found them. And my aunt, the Baroness of Rothschild, found me in there, and she sent an emissary to say that they're offering me a free scholarship to attend the university in Paris. I was 17 at the time. And so I had a problem, had a decision, Argentina, United States, France. I chose the United States for the reason that my brother, who had survived, wanted to come to the United States. He wasn't interested in going to Argentina, and he had no affinity to France, never having set foot in the place. Unlike me, I felt very French, but he had no affinity. So we came to America. I came a year before he did. I came on the German quota, which was easy to come by. My uncle sent an affidavit, which you needed in those days, and send the money for an airplane ticket. And I flew by plane, which was a great experience. It took a long time. We had to stop for refueling in all kinds of places, like Gander. Goose Bay and Gander in Scotland. So that's how I came to America. I came, and when I arrived, I mean, I thought I had no family. You know, my family was devastated by the war. I arrived in the airport, and it was LaGuardia Airport, was in those days, the Marine Terminal at LaGuardia. I arrived, mobs of people all yelling, Norbert, Norbert! I look, are they talking about me? No, it turns out my uncle had rounded up a whole crowd, and I had a whole reception committee waiting for me, which was nice.
To stop. I want to thank John Gray and Michael Laurentin from the library, Mr. Librarian, as usual, it's really helpful tonight. And Ken Walter and Norb for being with us. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to my story.